Hi, this is Dr. Ronald Hoffman. For decades, I've been preaching about the importance of a regimen of basic supplements that everyone should consider part of their daily health routine. So I came up with an easy way for you to get the exact combination of targeted supplements you need to help you follow the intelligent medicine lifestyle. The very same supplements I take myself and prescribe for my patients. Just go to DearHoffmanStore.com and check out my Intelligent Medicine Starter Kit. It's a short list of the basic supplements that I recommend as a starting point for those looking to take control of their health. They're the essential elements of a basic program that everyone could benefit from. And for a limited time, you'll get 10% off and free shipping on all of your store orders. For more details, just go to DearHoffmanStore.com. That's DearHoffmanStore.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and once again, we're here to answer your questions. Your questions come to us via radio program at AOL.com. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla, and with me is Layla Mutin. She's our nutritionist in residence. We work together on a daily basis at our offices in Manhattan. And how are you doing today, Layla?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman, how are you?
Very well, thank you. So, before we get to questions, radio program at AOL.com, by the way, the destination for questions, interesting article that I sent you, and I said, you know, please discuss.
Yeah.
read and discuss.
Yes.
And so, in essence, let me tell you how the article seems to have been portrayed in the media.
Mm-hmm.
It's an article which has two basic themes. It's about dieting.
Yes.
And it pits a low-fat diet versus a low-carb diet.
Mm-hmm.
And the takeaway message is, it doesn't matter which diet you follow,
yeah,
because both diets work equally well. And there's an additional wrinkle to it, which is a very interesting wrinkle, which I want to discuss with you also, which is that it wasn't just randomly assigned. It wasn't like half of the people went on low fat and half of the people went on low carb.
Mm-hmm.
It was, they were assigned to these diet groups on the basis of genetic testing.
Mm.
And this goes into the whole arena of something called nutrigenomics.
Yes.
Which is the idea, and we know, like, different strokes for different folks.
Yeah.
You know, one man's meat is another man's poison, et cetera, et cetera. We've
right.
known that for eons. And now we have the belief that based on certain genetic characteristics, perhaps ancestral characteristics, racial characteristics, that certain diets work better for certain people. So one might hypothesize, for example, that someone who is of Eskimo lineage or Viking lineage
yes.
might do well on a higher protein, lower carb diet because
right.
the introduction of grains was very late.
Walrus blubber.
Right, in those cultures, right?
Yes.
Okay?
Yeah.
So then, alternatively, we have certain cultures, such as the culture of ancient Mexico, the Incas,
yes.
African cultures, which relied heavily on starch-based foods.
Right, tubers.
For many, many centuries and perhaps millennia. So you
yes.
might say, well, people with a Hispanic background or African background or Middle Eastern background, perhaps where wheat was cultivated 10,000 years ago, perhaps they would do well on a low-fat diet because it wasn't as if they subsisted on woolly mammoth meat,
right?
You know, a mastodon meat or something like that. So I mean, it's an appealing idea,
mm-hmm.
and we actually field tested it in our practice for a while.
Yeah,
and we'll talk a little bit about our experience. But
yeah.
so tell us a little more about the study.
This study, okay, effect of a low-fat versus a low-carbohydrate diet on a 12-month weight loss in overweight adults. And the association with genotype pattern or insulin secretion. So
that's a mouthful.
That's a mouthful. So it was an RCT, randomized clinical trial, among 609 overweight adults.
Published in JAMA, I think.
Yeah, published in JAMA, as a matter of fact. Now, here's the thing. When I looked at the design, the settings, the interventions, all of that, they basically took...
See, that's, by the way, what yeah. you just did is what the vast majority of journalists... And
don't
even
do.
Scientists and readers don't do because
right.
they just read it. They read the headline.
They read the headline, or they read the abstract.
The abstract,
and they stop.
Which is a summary.
Exactly.
But what you need to do, and this is what we often do, and it's very boring.
Mm-hmm.
Really, is we go to like page
23.
Yeah.
And it says materials and methods.
Mm-hmm.
And in materials and methods, it says precisely what they did. So, for
right.
example, if you want to find like a study that says echinacea didn't work for colts, well, let's go to materials and methods.
Yeah.
And let's see what material do they actually use? What was the dosage?
Exactly.
What was the standardization?
Mm-hmm.
You know, where was it from? And that's how you actually can better understand some studies, sometimes critique studies who you just don't understand why they came to that conclusion.
Yeah.
There may be some question as to their methodology.
Right. And this is where we see a lot of flaws take place in the scientific literature. And unfortunately, this is another example of it.
Right.
So basically, they took half the people, 305, they put them on a low-fat diet. They took about another 304, put them on a low-carb diet. But then when I looked at the methodology, Dr. Hoffman, and when I look at the breakdown in the macronutrient distributions, 30% was for carbohydrates in the low-carb group. 30% carbohydrates as a macronutrient distribution is not a low-carb diet. If you base that...
So, for example, you have a patient and you want to get them to lose weight.
Right.
In your practice, in our practice, mutually,
mm-hmm.
I send them over and I say, well, I write low-carb diet.
Yeah.
You know, and then you implement that diet for the person. How much, what percentage of carbs will be in that diet?
Maybe 10, 15%.
Okay. Which translates to, just give people an idea what that might look like.
Based on a 2,000-calorie diet, 2,000-calorie a day diet, which is pretty standard, that's 150 grams of carbs a day.
So is that like almost no fruit?
No, there's fruit there.
There's fruit.
There's even baked potatoes and things like that and other starchy
in the 10%.
In the 10% there will be some fruit.
Okay.
Or there may be some, you know, it's really the vegetable allotment and the lower glycemic fruits.
Right.
But based on this study, they were allowed 150 grams of carbs a day. By definition not a low carb diet.
And just for visualization purposes, what constitutes 150 grams of carbohydrates? Give me an idea. In a day, how much?
In a day,
you're
having
baked potatoes or slices of bread.
Oh, you're having a bowl of steel cut oatmeal.
Okay.
You're having a bowl of steel cut oatmeal. You're easily getting 40 to 50 grams there. You might have a half cup of rice at dinner. That's definitely another 40 grams. And we're talking brown rice, not necessarily white rice. So you're getting that there. Add an additional sweet potato, possibly a sandwich at lunch,
mm-hmm.
maybe even an open-faced sandwich. This is not a low-carb diet. It's 150 grams.
So that's much more. Of course,
exactly.
For some people, that would be an improvement.
Yeah, oh, of course. If you were on the McDonald's and donut diet.
Right.
And eating a bucket of flan for dessert.
Like,
yeah, so that's an improvement.
Like it would be an improvement for Homer Simpson.
Sure, yes.
Okay.
But even based on a lower-calorie diet, say 1,600 calories a day, it's still 120 grams of carbs a day.
Mm-hmm.
That's way too much. When we're trying to lose weight, it's got to be 50 grams or less. So they did not compare what they set out to compare.
So, and this is, by the way, a very much a, I feel, a straw man argument that they set up in a lot of these experiments.
Yeah.
Because they evaluate the so-called low-carb diet with a non-representative low-carb diet.
Exactly.
Maybe what they think is, well, this is the more achievable, the more practical, the more acceptable or implementable diet that people will comply with.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they just don't go for the gold in terms of the real efficacy of this diet.
Right.
So, by the way, what were the results?
Well, the results were that they didn't really find a difference at all. There was no significant difference.
There was actually a little more weight loss in the low-carb diet.
There was.
It was like
a little
13
bit,
versus 11 and a half.
Exactly. Kilograms.
Pounds.
Yes, pounds.
Over what
pounds.
Period of time?
12 months.
So very, very slow weight loss. Very slow gradual weight loss.
Right. Well, it would have to be slow because even the low-carb plan was not low-carb.
Right.
So I have to think.
And by the way,
think,
they were all instructed. Both groups were instructed to avoid sugar and junk, right?
Yes.
So both groups, so it was.
These were healthy low-fat diets and healthy low-carb diets. So basically more of a whole foods diet like I described to you as an example of the grams of carbs.
Okay.
So, I can't help thinking if they truly implemented a real low-carb diet and did this comparison, they would get a very different result.
As they have in some other previous studies.
Yes.
By the way, if you look at previous studies, the low-carb diet generally, and I hate to keep using this word, trumps the low-fat diet.
Mm-hmm.
Invariably, if implemented correctly with the proper stringency. Now let's get to the genetic part.
Ah.
So Let's talk about our experience using genetic testing, which we did for a while.
Yes, we did.
We did it for a while. And
then it lost its glow.
Right. The bloom was off the rose on that. And why that happened is two things. First of all, it incurred unnecessary expense for patients because at first they assured us, oh, this is going to be covered by insurance. It's fine. Well, that kind of got very quickly blown out of the water as insurance companies became aware that this was not, quote, medically necessary. So a flood of denials came in for tests that originally were promised to be covered by insurance. So that's number one. Number two, it'd be one thing if the value of that was that you could absolutely, with some degree of precision, be assigned to your diet type.
Yes.
But what did we see?
What we're seeing is we're finding the scientific rigor is not yet there for the diet for your genotype. It's not ready for prime time yet.
Now, precluding the possibility that there's something there in that genetic material that
we
could guide us.
We want to see more rigor. Mm-hmm. I also don't like the idea of telling somebody that you are more prone, based on this genetic testing, to eating disinhibition. Mm-hmm. It almost adds a little bit of a victim quality to that.
So there's a gene, by the way, what does that mean? There's a gene for that.
There's a gene for that.
Which means
you will be more prone to eating disinhibition than maybe the person sitting next to you.
Well, aren't there some behavioral correlates to that?
Like
Absolutely. You should stay away from donut shops or something?
Exactly. Stay away from donut shops. Stay away from the foods that trigger you. There's all kinds of other things.
Right.
So the scientific rigor, even in the certain tests that we've used, out of 4 stars, we're only getting 2.
Right. But here's the other thing, that I would also point out is that genetic factors may determine your best diet, but that is sort of like saying that you may have a murder gene. But cultural factors and other life experiences, and even such factors that are outside your genome, like your microbiome, your body weight, which you've achieved, may influence or even override your genetic proclivity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So that's why this
I mean, if you have the murderer gene, if you hang out with people who are murderers, you will be more likely to murder.
Right.
Little to do with your genetics.
Right.
So the rigor's not there.
Yeah.
So I
agree with the part that the tests are, I mean, 2 take-homes from this. One, the low-fat diet and the low-carb diet are the same. It's just about calories.
Yes.
That's wrong.
It is wrong.
And I refute that part of the study. On the other hand, the part about the genes not making a big difference,
would you tell? Because you're not comparing a true low-carb diet to a low-fat diet.
In fact, that part of the conclusion is invalidated by the study design.
Yes.
Because it didn't really test the low-carb diet. So it didn't really invalidate the genetic thing.
That's right. So this conclusion is invalid.
However, I agree with that conclusion. Nonetheless, I don't think that...
Yes, for different reasons.
Because I would see people who are like very insulin resistant, and then they'd say, go on a very low-fat diet.
Mm.
Well, I don't know. It didn't seem to make sense.
No, not at all. And those who are very insulin resistant, we even stop fruit for a little while until all of that comes under control.
It's a reliable way to go.
Okay. So much for that study.
And, even such a simple marker as like a high triglycerides, could tell you that a person is generally going to do better on a low-carb diet.
Right.
Simple marker.
Yes.
That's like a...
It's also a marker of compliance.
Yes.
I get to see whether they're actually following
you.
You're busted. Your triglycerides are too high. You're not doing
triglycerides are 160. What are you doing?
Yeah. When they should be 70 or something like that.
All right. Well, very interesting study. I'm sorry we took so much time away from questions, but let's get to questions.
Yes. We have an email from Jeremy. I'm wondering, Dr. Hoffman, what do you think? Would you say that bone spurs are the result of a calcium deficiency? You may have heard of a Dr. Wallach. I'm sure you're familiar with him. He talks about calcium deficiency being the cause of bone spurs, and his protocols encourage bone and joint supplements and calcium, and that after about 4 to 6 months, these bone spurs would be reduced or would melt away. I'm interested because, like yourself, I'm a lifelong gym nut, who's 50 years old right now. And to the extent that I've had and continue to have problems with just about all of my major joints. In particular, I have spurs in both of my shoulders. Hmm. So.
Okay, so let's first consider the source. The source is Dr. Joel Wallach. Mm-hmm. And Joel Wallach came on my radar screen many years ago when he published, I guess it was a book, it was called Dead Doctors Don't Lie. And it was one of those books that was like kind of weird because it was typeset like by, you know, Gutenberg. You know, it was kind of like looked like a self-published book. But the contention in the book is that doctors on average die much younger mm-hmm. than regular folks. So how could that possibly attest to the benefits of Western medicine if the very same purveyors of Western medicine themselves experience premature death? Mm-hmm. Well, fact check on that. Doctors do succumb to the very same diseases that their patients succumb to, but at the same rate that patients do.
Yeah.
And so the average life expectancy of a doctor, even under, you know, the stress of being a doctor, the high suicide rate among doctors, you know, et cetera, is the same as for the average American. It's it's no greater. Well, you might expect maybe they're smarter, you know, they know more about medicine, medicine saves them. It's no greater nor no less.
Yeah.
So that dead doctors don't lie is, I mean, the whole concept of the doctors of premature death is mm-hmm. it's a lie. It's a deception. It's a rhetorical thing that's flung at the medical establishment by a guy whose whole stock and trade is basically attacking the medical establishment. Not that I don't attack the medical establishment, but I think you've been, when you're a one-note Charlie doing that, it kind of casts some doubt on your veracity and your credibility.
Yeah.
So in terms of his actual credentials, he's a veterinarian. Now, veterinarians, I have great discussions with my veterinarian friends.
Yeah.
They're brilliant. Mm-hmm. They are innovative in their treatment of animals. And, you know, in some cases, I'd prefer having them as a doctor than a regular
I love care. Vets in that they ask the right question. What are you feeding your pet?
Right.
That's what we need to be asked when we walk into a doctor's office.
And they use natural remedies a lot. And it's great. And they have more leeway to do that because it's actually a little less regulated. So anyway, but anyway, he's a vet. So, okay, that's not necessarily a knock on his qualifications to talk about humans. But there is no basis for believing that calcium causes or prevents bone spurs. Hmm. So you might think, well, you take a lot of calcium, it's going to go to your bones and could cause a bone spur. Well, that's the opposite of what he's saying. It's that calcium prevents bone spurs. Calcium, there's no evidence that calcium can prevent bone spurs or exacerbate bone spurs.
Yeah.
However, bone spurs occur because calcium gets deposited as a consequence of inflammation.
Yes.
And that's precisely what happens in your arteries. Before the calcium comes in, there's an inflammatory process, and the calcium's like spackle.
Yes.
You know, it's a repair mm-hmm. mechanism, and it's a repair mechanism that goes awry, basically.
Yeah. It's also a bit of a repetitive motion thing.
Sure.
Ask any waiter mm-hmm. who's carrying all the dishes on his shoulder on a tray. They will have a tendency to get a bone spur there. Holding a heavy purse for years and years and years on your shoulder on a very thin shoulder strap in the same place can cause the same thing.
Right.
So
it can cause a hell of a trapezius muscle spasm too.
Oh, yeah.
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 So anyway, so I don't agree. Mm-hmm. Was there any more to that?
No, that was it. And what to do about his bone spurs. Yeah.
Well, okay. Yeah. I mean, what to do about bone spurs is avoid the repetitive exercises that may inflame and lay off a little bit, diversify your exercise so that you're gently rehabbing if there's problems in inflammation.
Yeah.
And, you know, I get it. It's hard for inveterate athletes to stop. You know, I hate it when I'm sidelined, but, you know, sometimes you have to do it and do other things.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you can't run, swim. If you can't swim, go back to, you know, get on the bike, you know, et cetera.
Yeah.
And diversify your portfolio. Now I'm doing yoga, which further diversifies my portfolio. Some days I do strength training. Mm-hmm. But, you know, just do too much of anything, especially you get older. You'll get, you know, inflammation and bone spurs.
Yeah.
Any inflammatory diet, any inflammatory nutrients, fish oil, curcumin, boswellin, et cetera, you know. Maybe vitamin K, you know, because vitamin D and K
redirect
may regulate
the calcium.
May help prevent calcium from going to the wrong places. We think of that as possibly a crossing guard mechanism for telling calcium to stay away from the wrong places and go to the right places, like into your bones. But I'm not sure that's been strongly demonstrated.
Jeremy, thank you for your question.
Yep.
We hope you feel better soon. We have an email from Carolyn. Carolyn says, since you've addressed spironolactone as a drug for PCOS, I wonder if you could discuss the effects of prolonged spironolactone use in the very elderly for congestive heart failure. What can I do to protect and restore my 94-year-old father?
Okay, so let's talk about the drug spironolactone. Spironolactone is an old medication from the 80s. Mm-hmm. It's a diuretic. It's a what's called a potassium-sparing diuretic, which means that many diuretics, like hydrochlorothiazide, can dangerously deplete potassium, and that's dangerous in terms of heart. Mm-hmm. So spironolactone was developed as a diuretic or a water pill that causes you to basically excrete excess water without depleting your potassium. But as a consequence, it raises potassium so that you have to be monitored when you take it. And it can actually, according to some studies, because it's used a lot in older patients now with heart failure, it's been discovered that it really has an add-on beneficial effect in heart failure. It seems to work on something called the renin-angiotensin-aldactone system, which is the water and blood pressure regulating system of the body. So it's a blocker of aldactone. Thereby causes the body to excrete fluid but hold on to potassium. And it has an interesting corollary side effect, which is actually one of the main reasons it's used. It actually seems to block testosterone receptors. So it's used for women who suffer from PCOS. Polycystic ovarian syndrome or hirsutism. It can prevent hair loss, acne, and facial and body hair to some extent. I mean, it's a variable efficacy. Its side effects include excess potassium and fatigue. Some patients who take it experience fatigue. Older patients are at risk because they can get hyperkalemia, which is the too high overaccumulation of potassium, particularly older, you know, like 90-something individuals. But it really does help the heart.
Yeah.
And it also, not only does it take the pressure off the heart and, you know, get rid of excess water, because congestive heart failure is basically you're drowning, you know, in the fluid that you can't eliminate. It also seems to prevent cardiac fibrosis, which is the process by which the heart kind of hardens and gets stiff. So there's that property has meant that it's been re-embraced in cardiology. It was almost on its way out because of a lot of side effects.
Yeah.
It can cause, in men, it can cause gynecomastia, which is like breast tenderness.
Yeah.
Okay. It's certainly, by the way, in women who take it for the PCOS, it also kills their libido. That's a not happy side effect of that.
Right. So, you know, reducing testosterone.
I could
imagine.
Blocking androgens.
Blocking androgens.
So, you know, some think of it as a dirty drug, and a dirty in the sense that it has a lot of potential side effects. But I'm not a cardiologist, but I haven't seen a lot of patients lately who are on it, but apparently cardiologists like it.
Yeah. When I think of congestive heart failure, you think, at least in the integrative and functional medicine world, that it's a lack of energy
cardiac
in the heart. Cardiac energy. That beneficial would be lots and lots and lots of ubiquinol.
Very high dose.
Yeah.
And that's Stephen Sinatra's mantra is coenzyme Q10, but high dose, you know.
High dose.
6, 8, 10, 1200 milligrams.
Right.
And then, you know, the other things that help are carnitine, ribose, magnesium.
Yes.
Especially.
Those are the stars.
Yep.
For the heart. Wow. Carolyn, we wish you and your father the best of luck. Thank you for your question.
Okay.
Okay.
Good point at which to pause, because we divide these podcasts into two parts. And in part two, Layla, give us a preview of what we're going to be talking about.
I question the accuracy and potency of supplements available at groceries and drugstores, but I'm not convinced that the pricier stuff sold at specialty health food stores is any better. Can you help unscramble this?
Okay.
You're the answer man.
It's a throwdown challenge, and we're going to take it up in part two of today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm with Layla Mudin, our resident nutritionist, and it's our weekly Q&A with Layla. We'll be right back.